Side 1, A Treatise on White Magic, or The Way of the Disciple, by Alice A. Bailey. Recorded by Lucis Trust, New York. Copyright 1951 by Lucis Trust. First printing, 1934. This book contains 705 pages. Table of Contents. Introductory Remarks, page 3, side 1. Man's Three Aspects, page 18, side 1. Rule 1, Some Basic Assumptions, page 53, side 2. The Way of the Disciple, page 60, side 2. Rule 2, Hindrances to Occult Study, page 73, side 2. The Overcoming of the Hindrances, page 84, side 2. Rule 3, Soul, Light, and Body Light, page 93, side 3. Principles and Personalities, page 109, side 3. Rule 4, The Creative Work of Sound, page 125, side 3. Continuing Rule 4, The Science of the Breath, page 149, side 4. Rule 5, The Soul and Its Thought Forms, page 157, side 4. Heart, Throat, and Eye, page 189, side 4. Continuing Rule 5, The Awakening of the Centers, page 200, side 5. Rule 6, The Work of the Eye, page 211, side 5. Rule 7, The Battleground of the Astral Plane, page 219, side 5. The Two Paths, page 226, side 5. Rule 8, Types of Astral Force, page 235, side 5. Continuing Rule 8, Cyclic Ebb and Flow, page 242, side 6. Rule 9, The Necessity for Purity, page 257, side 6. Fundamental Forms, page 261, side 6. Rule 10, Thought Form Building, page 273, side 6. The Centers, Energies, and Rays, page 281, side 6. Continuing Rule 10, Astral Energy and Fear, page 293, side 7. The Right Use of Energy, page 311, side 7. The Present Age and the Future, page 321, side 7. Continuing Rule 10, The Founding of the Hierarchy, page 374, side 8. Continuing Rule 10, The New Group of World Servers, page 398, side 9. Continuing Rule 10, Astrology and the Energies, page 434, side 10. Rule 11, Analysis of the Three Sentences, page 447, page 10. Continuing Rule 11, Salvation from Our Thought Forms, page 481, side 11. Salvation from Death, page 492, side 11. Rule 12, Interludes and Cycles, page 511, side 11. Continuing Rule 12, The Prisoners of the Planet, page 521, side 12. Rule 13, The Quaternaries to be Recognized, page 541, side 12. The Precipitation of Thought Forms, page 552, side 12. Rule 14, The Centers and Prana, page 565, side 12. Continuing Rule 14, The Use of the Hands, page 575, side 13. The Treading of the Way, page 581, side 13. The Awakening of the Centers, page 587, side 13. Rule 15, The Esoteric Sense, page 601, side 13. The Negation of the Great Illusion, page 611, side 13. Continuing Rule 15, A Call to Service, page 618, side 14. The New Age Groups and Training, page 632, side 14. Index, deleted. The Great Invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men. The purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center, which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Quote, the above invocation or prayer does not belong to any person or group, but to all humanity. The beauty and the strength of this invocation lies in its simplicity and in its expression of certain central truths which all men innately and normally accept. The truth of the existence of a basic intelligence to whom we vaguely give the name of God. The truth that behind all outer seeming, the motivating power of the universe is love. The truth that a great individuality came to earth called by Christians the Christ and embodied that love so that we could understand. The truth that both love and intelligence are effects of what is called the will of God. And finally, the self-evident truth that only through humanity itself can the divine plan work out. Close quote. Alice A. Bailey. Extract from a statement by the Tibetan, published August 1934. Suffice it to say that I am a Tibetan disciple of a certain degree, and this tells you but little, for all are disciples from the humblest aspirant up to and beyond the Christ himself. I live in a physical body, like other men, on the borders of Tibet, and at times, from the exoteric standpoint, preside over a large group of Tibetan lamas when my other duties permit. It is this fact that has caused it to be reported that I am an abbot of this particular lamasery. Those associated with me in the work of the hierarchy, and all true disciples are associated in this work, know me by still another name and office. AAB knows who I am and recognizes me by two of my names. I am a brother of yours who has traveled a little longer upon the path than has the average student, and has therefore incurred greater responsibilities. I am one who has wrestled and fought his way into a greater measure of light than has the aspirant who will read this article, and I must therefore act as a transmitter of the light, no matter what the cost. I am not an old man, as age counts among the teachers, yet I am not young or inexperienced. My work is to teach and spread the knowledge of the ageless wisdom wherever I can find a response, and I have been doing this for many years. I seek also to help the Master M and the Master KH whenever opportunity offers, for I have been long connected with them and with their work. In all the above, I have told you much, yet at the same time I have told you nothing which would lead you to offer me that blind obedience and the foolish devotion which the emotional aspirant offers to the guru and master whom he is as yet unable to contact. Nor will he make that desired contact until he has transmuted emotional devotion into unselfish service to humanity, not to the master. The books that I have written are sent out with no claim for their acceptance. They may or may not be correct, true, and useful. It is for you to ascertain their truth by right practice and by the exercise of the intuition. Neither I nor AAB is the least interested in having them acclaimed as inspired writings, or in having anyone speak of them, with bated breath, as being the work of one of the masters. If they present truth in such a way that it follows sequentially upon that already offered in the world teachings, if the information given raises the aspiration and the will to serve from the plane of the emotions to that of the mind, the plane whereon the masters can be found, then they will have served their purpose. If the teaching conveyed calls forth a response from the illumined mind of the worker in the world and brings a flashing forth of his intuition, then let that teaching be accepted, but not otherwise. If the statements meet with eventual corroboration or are deemed true under the test of the law of correspondences, then that is well and good. But should this not be so, let not the student accept what is said. Rules for magic. Rule 1. The solar angel collects himself, scatters not his force, but in meditation deep communicates with his reflection. Rule 2. When the shadow hath responded, in meditation deep the work proceedeth. The lower light is thrown upward, the greater light illuminates the three, and the work of the four proceedeth. Rule 3. The energy circulates. The point of light, the product of the labors of the four, waxeth and groweth. The myriads gather round its glowing warmth until its light recedes. Its fire grows dim. Then shall the second sound go forth. Rule 4. Sound, light, vibration, and the form blend and merge, and thus the work is one. It proceedeth under the law, and naught can hinder now the work from going forward. The man breathes deeply. He concentrates his forces and drives the thought form from him. Rule 5. Three things engage the solar angel before the sheath created passes downward: the condition of the waters, the safety of the one who thus creates, and steady contemplation. Thus are the heart, the throat, and eye allied for triple service. Rule 6. The devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. They are driven forth and lose their master. Rule 7. The dual forces on the plane whereon the vital power must be sought are seen. The two paths face the solar angel. The poles vibrate. A choice confronts the one who meditates. Rule 8. The Agni Suryans respond to the sound. The waters ebb and flow. Let the magician guard himself from drowning at the point where land and water meet. The midway spot, which is neither dry nor wet, must provide the standing place whereon his feet are set. When water, land, and air meet, there is the place for magic to be wrought. Rule 9. Condensation next ensues. The fire and waters meet, the form swells and grows. Let the magician set his form upon the proper path. Rule 10. As the waters bathe the form created, they are absorbed and used. The form increases in its strength. Let the magician thus continue until the work suffices. Let the outer builders cease their labors then, and let the inner workers enter on their cycle. Rule 11. Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Next, pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. And finally, utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. Rule 12. The web pulsates. It contracts and expands. Let the magician seize the midway point and thus release those prisoners of the planet whose note is right and justly tuned to that which must be made. Rule 13. The magician must recognize the four, note in his work the shade of violet they evidence, and thus construct the shadow. When this is so, the shadow clothes itself, and the four become the seven. Rule 14. The sound swells out. The hour of danger to the soul courageous draweth near. The waters have not hurt the white creator, and naught could drown nor drench him. Danger from fire and flame menaces now, and dimly yet the rising smoke is seen. Let him again, after the cycle of peace, call on the solar angel. Rule 15. The fires approach the shadow, yet burn it not. The fire sheath is completed. Let the magician chant the words that blend the fire and water. From A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Introductory remarks. Man's three aspects. In the study of the ideas outlined in this book and their careful consideration, certain basic concepts are borne in mind. First, that the matter of prime importance to each student is not the fact of a particular teacher's personality, but the measure of truth for which he stands, and the student's power to discriminate between truth, partial truth, and falsity. Second, that with increased esoteric teaching comes increased exoteric responsibility. Let each student with clarity, therefore, take stock of himself, remembering that understanding comes through application of the measure of truth grasped to the immediate problem and environment, and that the consciousness expands through use of the truth imparted. Third, that a dynamic adherence to the chosen path and a steady perseverance that overcomes and remains unmoved by aught that may eventuate is a prime requisite and leads to the portal admitting to a kingdom, a dimension, and a state of being which is inwardly or subjectively known. It is this state of realization which produces changes in form and environment commensurate with its power. These three suggestions will merit a close consideration by all, and their significance must be somewhat grasped before further real progress is possible. It is not my function to make individual and personal application of the teaching given. That must be done by each student for himself. You have wisely guarded the teaching from the taint of superimposed authority, and there lies back of your books no esoteric principle of hierarchical authority or support, such as has produced the narrow limits of certain ecclesiastical bodies and groups, differing as widely as the Catholic Church, Christian Science, those who believe in the verbal inspiration of the scriptures, and numerous so-called esoteric organizations. The curse of many groups has been the whispered word that those who know wish, or the master says, or the great ones command, and the group of silly sheep feebly and blindly tumble over themselves to obey. They think thereby, through their misplaced devotion, to contact certain authoritative personages and to get into heaven by some shortcut. You have wisely guarded your books from the reaction accorded to those who claim to be masters, adepts, and initiates. My anonymity and status must be preserved, and my rank be regarded as only that of a senior student and of an aspirant to that expansion of consciousness which is for me the next step forward. What I say of truth alone is of moment. The inspiration and help I can accord to any pilgrim on the path is alone vital. That which I have learned through experience is at the disposal of the earnest aspirant, and the wideness of the vision which I can impart, owing to my having climbed higher up the mountain than some, is my main contribution. Upon these points the students are at liberty to ponder, omitting idle speculation as to the exact details of unimportant personalities and environing conditions. Our theme is to be that of the magic of the soul, and the key thought underlying all that may appear in this book is to be found in the words of the Bhagavad Gita, which runs as follows, quote, "Though I am unborn, the soul that passes not away, though I am the Lord of beings, yet as Lord over my nature I become manifest through the magical power of the soul," close quote. Gita 4, verse 6. The statistical and the academic is a necessary basis and a preliminary step for most scientific study, but in this book we will center our attention on the life aspect and the practical application of truth to the daily life of the aspirant. Let us study how we can become practical magicians and in what way we can best live the life of a spiritual man and of an aspirant to accepted discipleship in our own peculiar times, state, and environment. To do this, we will take the 15 rules for magic to be found in my earlier book entitled A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. I will comment on them, dealing not with their cosmic significance or with solar and other correspondences and analogies, but applying them to the work of the aspirant and giving practical suggestions for the better development of soul contact and soul manifestation. I shall take for granted certain knowledges and assume the students can follow and comprehend certain technical terms that I may be led to use. I am not dealing with babes, but with matured men and women who have chosen a certain way and who are pledged to walk in the light. I seek in this book to do four things and to make appeal to three types of people. It is based, as regards its teaching, upon four fundamental postulates. These are intended to, 1, teach the laws of spiritual psychology as distinguished from mental and emotional psychology, 2, make clear the nature of the soul of man and its systemic and cosmic relationships. This will include its group relationship as a preliminary step, 3, demonstrate the relations between the self and the sheaths which that self may use, and thus clarify public thought as to the constitution of man, 4, elucidate the problem of the supernormal powers and give the rules for their safe and useful development. We stand now towards the close of a great transition period, and the subtler realms of life are closer than ever before. Unusual phenomena and inexplicable happenings are commoner than at any time heretofore, whilst matters, telepathic, psychic, and peculiar, occupy the attention even of skeptics, scientists, and religionists. Reasons for the appearance of phenomena are being everywhere sought, and societies are formed for their investigation and demonstration. Many are likewise going astray in the effort to induce in themselves psychic conditions and the energy-producing factors which give rise to the manifestation of peculiar powers. This book will endeavor to fit the information given into the scheme of life as we today recognize it, and will show how basically natural and true is all that is termed mysterious. All is under law, and the laws need elucidation now that man's development has reached the stage of a juster appreciation of their beauty and reality. Three types of people will respond to this book. They are, 1, those open-minded investigators who are willing to accept its fundamentals as a working hypothesis until these are demonstrated to be erroneous. They will be frankly agnostic, but willing, temporarily, in their search for truth, to try out the methods and follow the suggestions laid down for their consideration. 2, aspirants and disciples. They will study this treatise in order to understand themselves better and because they seek to help their brother man. They will not accept its dicta blindly, but will experiment, check, and corroborate with care the stages and steps laid down for them in this section of the teachings of the Ageless Wisdom. 3. Initiates. These persons will arrive at a meaning which will not be apparent to those in the first group, and which will only be suspected by the more advanced members of the second. Within themselves, they know the truth of many of its statements, and will realize the subjective working out of many of the laws. These laws of nature have effects in three distinct realms. A. Physically, where they demonstrate as effects in the dense form. B. Etherically, where they demonstrate as the energy lying back of these effects. C. Mentally, where they concern the impulses which produce the other two. The treatise on cosmic fire dealt primarily with the solar system and only touched upon human aspects and correspondences insofar as they demonstrated the relation of the part to the whole and of the unit to the totality. The present book will deal more specifically with human development and unfoldment, elucidating the causes which are responsible for the present effects and pointing to the future and its possibilities and to the nature of the unfolding potentialities. This book will be based also upon 4 fundamental postulates, which must be admitted by the student of the succeeding pages as providing an hypothesis worthy of his consideration and trial. No true investigator of the Ageless Wisdom is asked to give blind adherence to any presentation of truth. He is asked, however, to have an open mind and seriously to weigh and consider the theories and ideals, the laws and the truths which have guided so many out of darkness into the light of knowledge and experience. The postulates might be enumerated as follows and are given in the order of their importance. Roman numeral 1. First, that there exists in our manifested universe the expression of an energy or life which is the responsible cause of the diverse forms and the vast hierarchy of sentient beings who compose the sum total of all that is. This is the so-called hylozoistic theory, though the term but serves to confuse. This great life is the basis of monism, and all enlightened men are monists. God is one, is the utterance of truth. One life pervades all forms, and those forms are the expressions, in time and space, of the central universal energy. Life in manifestation produces existence and being. It is the root cause, therefore, of duality. This duality, which is seen when objectivity is present, and which disappears when the form aspect vanishes, is covered by many terms, of which, for the sake of clarity, the most usual might be here listed. Spirit, matter, life, form, father, mother, positive, negative, darkness, light. Students must clearly have this essential unity in mind, even when they talk, as they needs must, in finite terms of that duality which is everywhere cyclically apparent. Roman numeral 2. The second postulate grows out of the first and states that the one life, manifesting through matter, produces a third factor, which is consciousness. This consciousness, which is the result of the union of the two poles of spirit and matter, is the soul of all things. It permeates all substance or objective energy. It underlies all forms, whether it be the form of that unit of energy which we call an atom, or the form of man, a planet, or a solar system. This is the theory of self-determination, or the teaching that all the lives of which the one life is formed, in their sphere and in their state of being, become, so to speak, grounded in matter and assume forms whereby their peculiar specific state of consciousness may be realized and their vibration stabilized. Thus they may know themselves as existences. Thus again, the one life becomes a stabilized and conscious entity through the medium of the solar system, and is essentially, therefore, the sum total of energies of all states of consciousness and of all forms in existence. The homogeneous becomes a heterogeneous, and yet remains a unity. The one manifests in diversity, and yet is unchanged. The central unity is known in time and space as composite and differentiated, and yet, when time and space are not, being but states of consciousness, only the unity will remain, and only spirit will persist, plus an increased vibratory action, plus capacity for an intensification of the light, when again the cycle of manifestation returns. Within the vibratory pulsation of the one manifesting life, all the lesser lives repeat the process of being. Gods, angels, men, and the myriad lives which express themselves through the forms of the kingdoms of nature and the activities of the evolutionary process, all become self-centered and self-determined. Roman numeral 3. The third basic postulate is that the object for which life takes form and the purpose of manifested being is the unfoldment of consciousness or the revelation of the soul. This might be called the theory of the evolution of light. When it is realized that even the modern scientist is saying that light and matter are synonymous terms, thus echoing the teaching of the East, it becomes apparent that through the interplay of the poles and through the friction of the pairs of opposites, light flashes forth. The goal of evolution is found to be a gradual series of light demonstrations. Veiled and hidden by every form lies light. As evolution proceeds, matter becomes increasingly a better conductor of the light, thus demonstrating the accuracy of the statement of the Christ, "I am the light of the world." Roman numeral 4. The fourth postulate consists of the statement that all lives manifest cyclically. This is the theory of rebirth or of reincarnation, the demonstration of the law of periodicity. Such are the great underlying truths which form the foundation of the ageless wisdom, the existence of life, and the development of consciousness through the cyclic taking of form. In this book, however, the emphasis will be laid upon the little life, upon man made in the image of God, who, through the method of reincarnation, unfolds his consciousness until it flowers forth as the perfected soul, whose nature is light and whose realization is that of a self-conscious identity. This developed unit has eventually to be merged with full intelligent participation in the greater consciousness of which it is a part. Before we take up our subject, it might be of value if we define certain words which will be in constant use, so that we will know what we are talking about and the significance of the terms we use. 1. Occult. This term concerns the hidden forces of being and those springs of conduct which produce the objective manifestation. The word conduct is used here deliberately, for all manifestation in all the kingdoms of nature is the expression of the life, purpose, and type of activity of some being or existence, and thus is literally the conduct, or outer nature, or quality, of a life. These springs of action lie hid in the purpose of any life, whether it be a solar life, a planetary entity, a man, or that being who is the sum total of the states of consciousness and of the forms of any kingdom in nature. 2. Laws. A law presupposes a superior being who, gifted with purpose and aided by intelligence, is so coordinating his forces that a plan is being sequentially and steadily matured. Through a clear knowledge of the goal, that entity sets in activity those steps and stages which, when carried forward in order, will bring the plan to perfection. The word law, as usually understood, conveys the idea of subjection to an activity which is recognized as inexorable and undeviating, but which is not understood by the one who is subjected to it. It involves, from one standpoint, the attitude of the submersed unit in the group impulse, and the inability of that unit to change the impulse or evade the issue. It inevitably brings about in the consciousness of the man who is considering these laws a feeling of being a victim, of being driven forward like a leaf before the breeze towards an end about which speculation only is possible, and of being governed by a force which acts apparently with an unavoidable pressure and thus produces group results at the expense of the unit. This attitude of mind is inevitable until the consciousness of man can be so expanded that he becomes aware of the greater issues. When, through contact with his own higher self, he participates in the knowledge of the objective, and when, through climbing the mountain of vision, his perspective changes and his horizon enlarges, he comes to the realization that a law is but the spiritual impulse, incentive, and life manifestation of that being in which he lives and moves. He learns that that impulse demonstrates an intelligent purpose, wisely directed and based on love. He then himself begins to wield the law or to pass wisely, lovingly, and intelligently through himself as much of that spiritual life impulse which his particular organism can respond to, transmit, and utilize. He ceases to obstruct and begins to transfer. He brings to an end the cycle of the closed, self-centered life and opens the doors wide to spiritual energy. In so doing, he finds that the law which he has hated and mistrusted is the vitalizing, purifying agency which is sweeping him and all God's creatures onto a glorious consummation. 3. Psychic. There are two types of the above force in manifestation as far as the human kingdom is concerned, and these must be clearly grasped. There is the force which animates the subhuman kingdoms in nature, the ensouling energy which, brought into conjunction with the energy of matter and self, produces all forms. The effect of this junction is to add to the embryo intelligence of substance itself a latent sentiency and responsiveness that produces that subjective something we call the animal soul. This exists in 4 degrees or states of sentient awareness. A. The consciousness of the mineral kingdom. B. The consciousness of the vegetable kingdom. C. The consciousness of the animal kingdom. D. The consciousness of the animal form through which the spiritual man functions, which, after all, is but a department of the former group in its highest presentation. Secondly, there is that psychic force which is the result of the union of the spirit with sentient matter in the human kingdom, and which produces a psychic center which we call the soul of man. This psychic center is a force center, and the force of which it is the custodian or which it demonstrates brings into play a responsiveness and an awareness which is that of the soul of the planetary life, a group consciousness which brings with it faculties and knowledge of a different order than that in the animal soul. These supersede eventually the powers of the animal soul which limit, distort, and imprison, and give man a range of contacts and a knowledge which is infallible, free from error, and which admits him to the freedom of the heavens. The effect of the free play of the soul of man serves to demonstrate the fallibility and relative uselessness of the powers of the animal soul. All I desire to do here is to show the two senses in which the word psychic is used. Later, we will deal with the growth and development of the lower psychic nature, or the soul of the vehicles in which man functions in the three worlds, and then we'll seek to elucidate the true nature of the soul of man and of the powers which can be brought into play once a man can contact his own spiritual center, the soul, and live in that soul consciousness. 4. Unfoldment. The life at the heart of the solar system is producing an evolutionary unfoldment of the energies of that universe which it is not possible for finite man as yet to vision. Similarly, the center of energy which we call the spiritual aspect in man is, through the utilization of matter or substance, producing an evolutionary development of that which we call the soul and which is the highest of the form manifestations, the human kingdom. Man is the highest product of existence in the three worlds. By man, I mean the spiritual man, a son of God in incarnation. the forms of all the kingdoms of nature, human, animal, vegetable, and mineral, contribute to that manifestation. The energy of the third aspect of divinity tends to the revelation of the soul, or the second aspect, which in turn reveals the highest aspect. It must ever be remembered that the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky expresses this with accuracy in the words, "Life we look upon as the one form of existence manifesting in what is called matter, or what, incorrectly separating them, we name spirit, soul, and matter in man. Matter is the vehicle for the manifestation of soul on this plane of existence, and soul is the vehicle on a higher plane for the manifestation of spirit. And these three are a trinity synthesized by life which pervades them all." From The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, pages 79 and 80. Through the use of matter, the soul unfolds and finds its climax in the soul of man, and this treatise will concern itself with the unfoldment of that soul and its discovery by man. 5. Knowledge might be divided into three categories. First, there is theoretical knowledge. This includes all knowledge of which man is aware, but which is accepted by him on the statements of other people and by the specialists in the various branches of knowledge. It is founded on authoritative statements and has in it the element of trust in the writers and speakers and in the trained intelligences of the workers in any of the many and varied fields of thought. The truths accepted as such have not been formulated or verified by the one who accepts them, lacking as he does the necessary training and equipment. The dicta of science, the theologies of religion, and the findings of the philosophers and thinkers everywhere color the point of view and meet with a ready acquiescence from the untrained mind, and that is the average mind. Then secondly, we have discriminative knowledge, which has in it a selective quality and which posits the intelligent appreciation and practical application of the more specifically scientific method and the utilization of test, the elimination of that which cannot be proved, and the isolation of those factors which will bear investigation and are in conformity with what is understood as law. The rational, argumentative, scholastic, and concretizing mind is brought into play with the result that much that is childish, impossible, and unverifiable is rejected, and a consequent clarifying of the fields of thought results. This discriminating and scientific process has enabled man to arrive at much truth in relation to the three worlds. The scientific method is, in relation to the mind of humanity, playing the same function as the occult method of meditation in its first two stages of concentration and prolonged concentration or meditation plays in relation to the individual. Through it, right processes of thought are engendered. Non-essentials and incorrect formulations of truth are ultimately eliminated or corrected, and the steady focusing of the attention either upon a seed thought, a scientific problem, a philosophy, or a world situation results in an ultimate clarifying and the steady seeping in of right ideas and sound conclusions. The foremost thinkers in any of the great schools of thought are simply exponents of occult meditation, and the brilliant discoveries of science, the correct interpretations of nature's laws, and the formulations of correct conclusions, whether in the fields of science, of economics, of philosophy, psychology, or elsewhere, is but the registering by the mind, and subsequently by the brain, of the eternal verities, and the indication that the race is beginning also to bridge the gap between the objective and the subjective, between the world of form and the world of ideas. This leads inevitably to the emergence of the third branch of knowledge, the intuitive. The intuition is, in reality, only the appreciation by the mind of some factor in creation, some law of manifestation, and some aspect of truth known by the soul, emanating from the world of ideas and being of the nature of those energies which produce all that is known and seen. These truths are always present, and these laws are ever active, but only as the mind is trained and developed, focused and open-minded, can they be recognized, later understood, and finally adjusted to the needs and demands of the cycle and time. Those who have thus trained the mind in the art of clear thinking, the focusing of the attention and consequent receptivity to truth, have always been with us, but hitherto have been few and far between. They are the outstanding minds of the ages, but now they are many and increasingly found. The minds of the race are in process of training, and many are hovering on the borders of a new knowledge. The intuition which guides all advanced thinkers into the newer fields of learning is but the forerunner of that omniscience which characterizes the soul. The truth about all things exists, and we call it omniscience, infallibility, the correct knowledge of the Hindu philosophy. When man grasps a fragment of it and absorbs it into the racial consciousness, we call it the formulation of a law, a discovery of one or other of nature's processes. Hitherto, this has been a slow and piecemeal undertaking. Later, and before so very long, light will pour in, truth will be revealed, and the race will enter upon its heritage, the heritage of the soul. In some of our considerations, speculation must perforce enter in. Those who see a vision that is withheld from those lacking the necessary equipment for its apprehension are regarded as fanciful and unreliable. When many see the vision, its possibility is admitted, but when humanity itself has the awakened and open eye, the vision is no longer emphasized, but a fact is stated and a law enunciated. Such has been the history of the past, and such will be the process in the future. The past is purely speculative from the standpoint of the average man, and the future is equally so, but he himself is the result of that past, and the future will work out of the sum total of his present characteristics and qualities. If this is true of the individual, it is then also equally true of mankind as a whole. That unit in nature, which we call the fourth or human kingdom, represents that which is the product of its physical heritage. Its characteristics are the sum of its emotional and mental unfoldments, and its assets are those which it has succeeded in accumulating during the cycles wherein it has been wrestling with its environment, the sum total of the other kingdoms in nature. Within the human kingdom lie potentialities and latencies, characteristics and assets which the future will reveal and which in their turn determine that future. I have purposely chosen to begin with the undefinable and the unrecognized. The soul is as yet an unknown quantity. It has no real place in the theories of the academic and scientific investigators. It is unproven and regarded by even the most open-minded of the academicians as a possible hypothesis, but lacking demonstration. It is not accepted as a fact in the consciousness of the race. Only two groups of people accept it as a fact. One is the gullible, undeveloped, childlike person who, brought up on a scripture of the world and being religiously inclined, accepts the postulates of religion, such as the soul, God, and immortality, without questioning. The other is that small but steadily growing band of knowers of God and of reality who know the soul to be a fact in their own experience but are unable to prove its existence satisfactorily to the man who admits only that which the concrete mind can grasp, analyze, criticize, and test. The ignorant and the wise meet on common ground as extremes always do. In between are those who are neither totally ignorant nor intuitively wise. They are the mass of the educated people who have knowledge but not understanding, and who have yet to learn the distinction between that which can be grasped by the rational mind, that which can be seen by the mind's eye, and that which only the higher or abstract mind can formulate and know. This ultimately merges in the intuition, which is the knowing faculty of the intelligent and practical mystic, who, relegating the emotional and feeling nature to its own place, uses the mind as a focusing point and looks out through that lens upon the world of the soul. Man's three aspects. One of the main means whereby man arrives at an understanding of that great sum total we call the macrocosm, God functioning through a solar system, is by an understanding of himself, and the Delphic injunction, "Man, know thyself," was an inspired utterance intended to give man the clue to the mystery of deity. Through the law of analogy or correspondences, the cosmic processes and the nature of the cosmic principles are indicated in the functions, structure, and characteristics of a human being. They are indicated, but not explained or elaborated. They serve simply as signposts, directing man along the path whereon future signposts may be found and more definite indications noted. The comprehension of that triplicity of spirit, soul, and body lies as yet beyond man's achievement, but an idea as to their relationship and their general coordinated function may be indicated by consideration of man from the physical side and his objective functioning. There are three aspects of man's organism which are symbols, and symbols only, of the three aspects of being. 1. The energy or activating principle, which withdraws mysteriously at death, partially withdraws in the hours of sleep or of unconsciousness, and which seems to use the brain as its main seat of activity, and from there to direct the functioning of the organism. This energy has a primary direct relation with the three parts of the organism which we call the brain, the heart, and the breathing apparatus. This is the microcosmic symbol of spirit. 2. The nervous system, with its complexities of nerves, nerve centers, and that multiplicity of interrelated and sensitive parts which serve to coordinate the organism, to produce the sensitive response which exists between the many organs and parts which form the organism as a whole, and which serve also to make the man aware of and sensitive to his environment. This entire sensory apparatus is that which produces the organized awareness and coordinated sensitivity of the entire human being, first within itself as a unit, and secondly its responsiveness and sensitive reaction to the world within which it plays its part. This nervous structure, coordinating, correlating, and producing an outer and inner group activity, demonstrates primarily through the three parts of the nervous system. A. Cerebrospinal system, B. Sensory system of nerves, C. Peripheral system of nerves. It is closely associated with the energy aspect, being the apparatus utilized by that energy to vitalize the body, to produce its coordinated activity and functioning, and to bring about an intelligent rapport with the world in which it has to play its part. It lies back, if one might use such an expression, of the body nature proper, back of the mass of the flesh and bone and muscle. It, in its turn, is motivated by and controlled by two factors. A. The sum total of the energy, which is the individual quota of vital energy. B. The energy of the environment in which the individual finds himself and within which he has to function and to play his part. This coordinating nervous system, this network of interrelating and sensitive nerves, is the symbol in man of the soul and an outer and visible form of an inner spiritual reality. 3. There is finally what might be described as the body, the sum total of flesh, of muscle, and of bone, which the man carries around, correlated by the nervous system and energized by what we vaguely call his life. In these three, the life, the nervous system, and the body mass, we find the reflection and the symbol of the greater whole, and by a close study of these and a comprehension of their functions and group relation, we can arrive at an understanding of some of the laws and principles which direct the activities of God in nature, a phrase sublimely true and equally finitely false. The three aspects of divinity, the central energy or spirit, the coordinating force or soul, and that which these two use and unify, are in reality one vital principle manifesting in diversity. These are the three in one, the one in three, God in nature, and nature itself in God. Carrying the concept, for the sake of illustration, into other realms of thought, this trinity of aspects can be seen functioning in the religious world as the esoteric teaching, the fundamental symbology and doctrines of the great world religions and the exoteric organizations. In government, it is the sum total of the will of the people, whatever that will may be, the formulated laws, and the exoteric administration. In education, it is the will to learn, the arts and sciences, and the great exoteric educational systems. In philosophy, it is the urge to wisdom, the interrelated schools of thought, and the outer presentation of the teachings. Thus, this eternal triplicity runs through every department of the manifested world, whether viewed as that which is tangible, or as that which is sensitive and coherent, or that which is energizing. It is that intelligent activity which has been clumsily called awareness. It is the capacity of awareness itself, involving as it does sensitive response to environment and the apparatus of that response, the divine duality of the soul. It is finally the sum total of that which is contacted and known. It is that of which the sensitive apparatus becomes aware. This, as we shall see later, is a gradually growing realization, shifting ever into more esoteric and inner realms. These three aspects are seen in man, the divine unit of life. First, he recognizes them in himself. Then he sees them in every form in his environment. And finally, he learns to relate these aspects of himself to the similar aspects in other forms of divine manifestation. Correct relation between forms will result in the harmonizing and right adjustment of physical plane life. Correct response to one's environment will result in correct rapport with the soul aspect hidden in every form, and will produce right relations between the various parts of the inner nervous structure to be found in every kingdom of nature, subhuman and superhuman. This is as yet practically unknown, but is rapidly coming into recognition, and when it is proven and realized, it will be discovered that therein lies the basis of brotherhood and of unity. As the liver, the heart, the lungs, the stomach, and other organs in the body are separate in existence and in function, and yet are unified and brought into relation through the medium of the nervous system throughout the body, so will it be found that in the world such organisms as the kingdoms in nature have their separate life and functions, yet are correlated and coordinated by a vast intricate sensory system which is sometimes called the soul of all things, the anima mundi, the underlying consciousness. In dealing with the triplicities so often used when speaking of deity, such as spirit, soul, and body, life, consciousness, and form, it is of value to remember that they refer to differentiations of the one life, and that the more of these triplicities with which one can familiarize oneself, the more one will be in rapport with a wider circle of men. But when one is dealing with things occult and subjective, and when the subject about which one writes deals with the undefinable, then difficulty is encountered. It is no difficult matter to describe a man's personal appearance, his clothing, his form, and the things with which he is surrounded. Language suffices satisfactorily to deal with the concrete and with the world of form. But when one endeavors to convey an idea of his quality, character, and nature, one is immediately faced with the problem of the unknown, with that undefinable, unseen part which we sense, but which remains in a large sense unrevealed and unrealized even by the man himself. How then shall we describe him through the medium of language? If this is so of man, how much greater is the difficulty when we seek through words to express that inexpressible sum total of which the terms spirit, soul, and body are regarded as the main component differentiations? How shall we define that undefinable life that men have, for the sake of understanding, limited and separated into a trinity of aspects or persons, calling the whole by the name of God? Yet where this differentiation of God into a trinity is universal and age-long in use, where every people, ancient and modern, employ the same triplicity of ideation to express an intuitive realization, there is warrant for the usage. That some day we may think and express the truth differently may indeed be so, but for the average thinker of today, the terms spirit, soul, and body stand for the aggregate of divine manifestation, both in the deity of the universe and in that lesser divinity, man himself. As this treatise is intended for the thinking human being and not for the crystallized theologians or the theoretically biased scientists, we will adhere to the well-used terminology and seek to understand what has lain back of the phrases in which man has sought to explain God himself. God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth, states one of the scriptures of the world. Man became a living soul is to be found in another place in the same scripture. I pray God your whole spirit and soul and body may be preserved blameless, said a great initiate of the White Lodge, and the greatest of them all yet present with us in physical form on earth repeated the words of an earlier sage when he said, I have said ye are gods, and ye are all the children of the Most High. In those words, the triplicity of man, his divinity and his relationship to the life in whom he lives and moves and has his being, is touched upon from the Christian standpoint, and all the great religions deal in analogous phrases with that relationship. A. Spirit, life, energy. The word spirit is applied to that undefinable, elusive, essential impulse or life which is the cause of all manifestation. It is the breath of life and is that rhythmic inflow of vital energy which manifests in its turn as the attractive force, as the consciousness or soul, and is the sum total of atomic substance. It is a correspondence in the great existence or macrocosm of that which in the little existence or microcosm is the vital inspiring factor which we call the life of man. This is indicated by the breath in his body, which is abstracted or withdrawn when the life course is run. What this something is, who shall say? We trace it back to the soul or consciousness aspect, and from the soul to the spirit, as we call the three aspects of the one breath. But what these words really signify, who has the courage to declare? We call this unknown something by differing names according to our particular school of thought. We seek to express it in words and end by calling it spirit, the one life, the monad, energy. Again, we must remember that understanding as to the nature of this one life is purely relative. Those who are engrossed in the form side of existence think in terms of physical vitality, of feeling, impulse, or of mental force, and do not pass beyond that unified life consciousness of which all the above are differentiations. Those, again, who are interested in the more metaphysical approach and in the soul life, more than in the form aspect, express their concept in terms of soul manifestation and, passing beyond the personal selfish reactions of the body nature, think in terms of life, in terms of quality, of group will or power, group coordination or love wisdom, and of group intelligence or knowledge, covering all by the generic term of brotherhood. But even that is found to be separative through the separation into larger units than the lower is capable of grasping. Therefore, the initiate, especially after the third initiation, begins to think even more synthetically and to express truth to himself in terms of spirit, life, the one. These terms mean to him something significant, but something so far removed from the concept of ordinary thinking humanity that it is needless for me to enlarge further upon it. This brings me to a point that should be dealt with here prior to any further expansion of our subject. In the treatise on cosmic fire and in the above passage, it frequently appears that teaching is carried forward to a certain point and then dropped with the statement that, owing to the point in evolution of the average man, his reaction to truth and the reaction of the disciple student or the initiate will differ. This is necessarily so. Each will read into the words his own state of consciousness. Each will fail to interpret in terms of the more advanced reaction of those on a higher stage of the ladder of evolution. The average reader, however, objects to being forced to recognize wider points of view than his own, and the phraseology which says, "It is needless to enlarge on this, for it would only be understood by the initiate," serves only to aggravate him. Tends to make him believe that evasion is intended and that the writer, having got out of his depth, is seeking to save his face by some such statement. Just as a scientific treatise would prove meaningless and a mere jumble of words to the average grammar school child, but would carry a clear definition and meaning to experts in the subject owing to training and mental development, so there are those to whom the subject of the soul and its nature, as dealt with in such an instruction as this, is as clear and lucid as current literature is to the average reader, and the best sellers, as you call them, to the general public. Equally, though fewer in number, there are those advanced souls to whom the spirit and its nature is also a rational and understandable subject, to be appreciated and comprehended through the medium of the soul and its powers, just as it is possible to arrive at an understanding of the soul through the medium of the mind correctly employed. On a lower level altogether, we know it is easy to understand the nature of the physical body through a study and right use of the desire nature. It is a form of pride, and a refusal to recognize one's temporary limitations that awakens in readers a dislike for phrases which aptly and truly say, "When you are further developed, you will understand the above." This should be made clear. To the master of the wisdom, the nature of the spirit, or that positive center of life which every form hides, is no more a mystery than is the nature of the soul to the esoteric psychologist. The source of the one life, the plane or state from which that life emanates, is the great hidden mystery to the members of the hierarchy of adepts. The nature of spirit, its quality and type of cosmic energy, its rate of vibration, and its basic cosmic differentiations are the study of initiates above the third degree and the subject of their investigations. They bring to that study a fully developed intuition, plus that mental interpretative capacity which their cycle of incarnation has developed. They employ the awakened and developed inner light of their souls to interpret and comprehend that life which, divorced from the world of form, persists on the higher levels of consciousness and penetrates into our solar system from some exterior center of being. They throw this light, which is in them and which they manipulate and use, in two directions, therefore, standing as they do in the midmost state and functioning as they choose to function on the plane of the intuition or of buddhi. They cast that light into the world of form and know all things, interpreting all with correctness. They cast that light into the formless realms of the higher three planes, formless from the standpoint of man in the three worlds below the intuitional plane, and seek to understand through steady expansive growth the nature and purpose of that which is neither body nor soul, neither force nor matter, but which is the cause of both in the universe. Eventually, when the initiate has undergone the higher solar initiations and can function in the full consciousness of the monad, awareness of that which is divorced even from group form and from those nebulous sheaths which veil and hide the one becomes possible. The highest types of consciousness work from the plane of the monad, as the initiate of lower degree works from the plane of the soul and uses the organs of perception, if such an unsatisfactory phrase is legitimate, and means of knowledge of which average man has no idea. They penetrate or include within their radius of awareness that sum total of life, consciousness, and form which we designate God. These initiates of high degree then begin to be aware of a vibration, a revealing light, a note or directional indicating sound which emanates from outside our solar system altogether. The only way in which we can get an appreciation of the process followed in the expansion of the divine consciousness in man is to study the relation of the mind and the brain and note what follows when the brain becomes the intelligent instrument of the mind. Then study the relation of the soul to the mind and what eventuates when man is directed by his soul and utilizes the mind to control the physical plane activities through the medium of the brain. In these three, soul, mind, and brain, we have the analogy and the clue to the understanding of spirit, soul, and body, and their mutual functions. This was the subject matter of the book, The Light of the Soul. Upon the perfecting of the conditions dealt with in that book, there follows still another expansion when the spirit aspect, man's emanating source of energy, begins to use the soul via the intuition and to impress upon the soul consciousness those laws, knowledges, forces, and inspirations which will make the soul the instrument of the spirit or monad, just as the personal man became at an earlier stage, via the mind, the instrument of the soul. In that earlier stage, the development was twofold. As the soul assumed control via the mind, so the brain became responsive to the soul. Man was awakened to a knowledge of himself, as he really was, and to the three worlds of his normal evolution. Later, he became group conscious and was no longer a separated individual. As the soul is brought under the dominance of the spirit, an analogous two stages are likewise seen. First, the disciple becomes aware not only of his group and allied groups, but his consciousness is expanded until it might be called planetary consciousness. Secondly, he begins to merge that planetary awareness into something more synthetic still, and gradually develops the consciousness of the greater life, which includes the planetary life, as man includes in his physical expression such living organisms as his heart or brain. When this takes place, he begins to comprehend the significance of spirit, the one life back of all forms, the central energy which is the cause of all manifestation. The first reaction of the average student on reading the above is to think immediately of the body nature as it expresses some type or other of energy. Thus the duality is the thing noted, and that which employs the thing is present in his mind. Yet one of the main necessities before occult aspirants at this time is to endeavor to think in terms of the one reality, which is energy itself, and nothing else. Therefore, it is of value to emphasize in our discussion of this abstruse subject the fact that spirit and energy are synonymous terms and are interchangeable. Only in the realization of this can we arrive at the reconciliation of science and religion, and at a true understanding of the world of active phenomena by which we are surrounded and in which we move. The terms organic and inorganic are largely responsible for much of the confusion and the sharp differentiation existing in the minds of many people between body and spirit, between life and form, and have led to a refusal to admit the essential identity in nature of these two. The world in which we live is regarded by the majority as really solid and tangible, yet possessing some mysterious power, lying concealed within it, which produces movement, activity, and change. This is, of course, putting it crudely, but it suffices to sum up the unintelligent attitude. The orthodox scientist is largely occupied with structures and relationships, with the composition of forms and with the activity produced by the component form parts and their interrelations and dependencies. The chemicals and elements and the functions and parts they play and their mutual interactions as they compose all forms in all the kingdoms of nature are the subject of their investigation. The nature of the atom, of the molecule, and the cell, their functions, the qualities of their force manifestations, and the varying types of activity, the solving of the problem as to the character and nature of the energies, focalized or localized in the differing forms of the natural or material world, demand the consideration of the ablest minds in the world of thought. Yet the questions, what is life, or what is energy, or what is the process of becoming and the nature of being, remain unanswered. The problem as to the why and the wherefore is regarded as fruitless and speculative and almost insoluble. Nevertheless, through pure reason and through the correct functioning of the intuition, these problems can be solved and these questions answered. Their solution is one of the ordinary revelations and attainments of initiation. The only true biologists are initiates of the mysteries, for they have an understanding of life and its purpose, and are so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects, and all their activities in connection with the work of the planetary hierarchy are based on a few fundamental formulas which concern life as it makes itself felt through its three differentiations or aspects, energy, force, matter. It should be noted here that only as a man understands himself can he arrive at an understanding of that which is the sum total that we call God. This is a truism and an occult platitude, but when acted upon, leads to a revelation which makes the present unknown God a recognized reality. Let me illustrate. Man knows himself to be a living being and calls death that mysterious process wherein something which he commonly designates as the breath of life is withdrawn. On its withdrawal, the form disintegrates. The cohesive vitalizing force is gone, and this produces a falling apart into its essential elements of that which has hitherto been regarded as the body. This life principle, this basic essential of being, and this mysterious elusive factor is the correspondence in man of that which we call spirit or life in the macrocosm. Just as the life in man holds together, animates, vitalizes, and drives into activity the form, and so makes of him a living being, so the life of God, as the Christian calls it, performs the same purpose in the universe and produces that coherent, living, vital ensemble which we call a solar system. This life principle in man manifests in a triple manner. One, as the directional will, purpose, basic incentive. This is the dynamic energy which sets his being functioning, brings him into existence, fixes the term of his life, carries him through the years, long or short, and abstracts itself at the close of his life cycle. This is the spirit in man manifesting as the will to live, to be, to act, to pursue, to evolve. In its lowest aspect, this works through the mental body or nature, and in connection with the dense physical, makes itself felt through the brain. 2. As the coherent force. It is that significant essential quality which makes each man different, which produces that complex manifestation of moods, desires, qualities, complexes, inhibitions, feelings, and characteristics which produce a man's peculiar psychology. This is the result of the interplay between the spirit or energy aspect and the matter or body nature. This is the distinctive subjective man, his coloring or individual note. This it is which sets the rate of vibratory activity of his body, produces his particular type of form, is responsible for the condition and nature of his organs, his glands, and his outer aspects. This is the soul, and, in its lowest aspect, is to be seen working through the emotional or astral nature, and, in connection with the dense physical body, through the heart. 3. As the activity of the atoms and cells of which the physical body is composed. It is the sum total of those little lives of which the human organs, comprising the entire man, are composed. These have a life of their own and a consciousness which is strictly individual and identified. This aspect of the life principle works through the etheric or vital body and, in connection with the solid mechanism of the tangible form, through the spleen. Therefore, let us remember that the definition of spirit is not possible of accomplishment, nor is the definition of God. When one says that spirit is the inexpressible, undefinable cause, the emanating energy, the one life and source of being, the totality of all forces, of all states of consciousness and of all forms, the aggregate of life and that which is actively manifested of that life, the self and the not-self, force and all that force motivates, one is in reality evading the issue, attempting the impossible and hiding truth behind a form of words. This cannot, however, be avoided until such time as the soul consciousness is touched and known, and the formless one can be perceived through the clear light of the intuition. One of the first lessons we need to learn is that our minds, being as yet unresponsive to the hidden intuitions, make it impossible for us to say with assurance that such a condition is this, that, or the other. That until we can function in our soul consciousness, it is not for us to say what is or what is not. That until we have submitted ourselves to the needed training, we are in no position to deny or affirm anything. Our attitude should be that of reasonable inquiry, and our interest that of the investigating philosopher, willing to accept an hypothesis on the basis of its possibility, but being unwilling to acknowledge as proven truth anything until we know it for and in ourselves. I, an aspirant to the higher mysteries, and one who has searched into them for a longer period than has been possible as yet to many, may write of things as yet impossible of demonstration to you or to the public who may read these instructions. To me they may be and are truth and proven fact, and for me that may suffice. For you they should be regarded as significant possibilities and hints as to the direction in which truth may be sought, but beyond that you should not permit yourself to go. The value of these instructions lies in their sum total and is to be found in the underlying structure or skeleton of coordinated and correlated statements which must be considered as a whole and not in detail, and this for two reasons. 1. Language, as earlier said, hides truth and does not reveal it. If truth is recognized, it is because the investigating student has found a point of truth in himself which serves to illumine his steps as he slowly and gradually presses forward. 2. There are many types of minds, and it is not to be expected that the information given, for instance, in this treatise, will appeal to all. It should be remembered that all people are units of consciousness breathed forth on one of the seven emanations from God. Therefore, even their monads or spiritual aspects are inherently different, just as in the prism, which is one, there are the seven differentiated colors. Even this is so only because of the nature and point of view and the perceiving apparatus of the man whose eye registers and differentiates the varying rates of vibratory light. These seven subsidiary groups again produce a varying outlook, mentality, and approach, all equally right, but all presenting a slightly different angle of vision. When the above realization is coupled to such factors as the different points in evolution, varying nationalities and characteristics, the inherent distinctions brought about through the interplay between the physical body involved and the environment, it will be apparent that no approach to such abstruse subjects as the nature of spirit and soul could have a general definition and submit themselves to a universal terminology. B. The soul, the mediator, or middle principle. There are two angles or points of view from which the nature of the soul must be grasped. One is the aspect of the soul in relation to the fourth kingdom in nature, i.e., the human, and the other, that of the subhuman kingdoms in nature, which, it must be remembered, are reflections of the three higher. It should be borne in mind that the soul of matter, the anima mundi, is the sentient factor in substance itself. It is the responsiveness of matter throughout the universe, and that innate faculty in all forms, from the atom of the physicist to the solar system of the astronomer, which produces the undeniable intelligent activity which all demonstrate. It can be called attractive energy, coherency, sentiency, aliveness, awareness or consciousness, but perhaps the most illuminating term is that the soul is the quality which every form manifests. It is that subtle something which distinguishes one element from another, one mineral from another. It is the intangible, essential nature of the form which, in the vegetable kingdom, determines whether a rose or a cauliflower, an elm or a watercress, shall come into being. It is a type of energy which distinguishes the varying species of the animal kingdom and makes one man different from another in his appearance, nature, and character. The scientist has tabulated, investigated, and analyzed the forms. Names have been selected and given to the elements and the minerals, the forms of vegetable life, and the varying species of animals. The structure of the forms and the history of their evolutionary progress have been studied, and deductions and conclusions have been reached. But the solution of the problem of life itself still eludes the wisest, and until the understanding of the web of life, or of the body of vitality which underlies every form and links every part of a form with every other part, is recognized and known to be a fact in nature, the problem will remain unsolved. The definition of the soul may be regarded as somewhat more feasible than that of spirit, owing to the fact that there are many people who have experienced at some time or another an illumination, an unfoldment, an uplifting, and a beatitude which has convinced them that there is a state of consciousness so far removed from that normally experienced as to bring them into a new state of being and a new level of awareness. It is something felt and experienced, and involves that psychic expansion which the mystic has registered down the ages, and which St. Paul referred to when he spoke of being caught up to the third heaven, and of hearing things there which it is not lawful for man to utter. When hearing and sight on those levels are both producing registered experience, then we have the occultist plus the mystic. 1. The soul, macrocosmic and microcosmic, universal and human, is that entity which is brought into being when the spirit aspect and the matter aspect are related to each other. A. The soul, therefore, is neither spirit nor matter, but is the relation between them. B. The soul is the mediator between this duality. It is the middle principle, the link between God and his form. C. Therefore, the soul is another name for the Christ principle, whether in nature or in man. 2. The soul is the attractive force of the created universe, and, when functioning, holds all forms together so that the life of God may manifest or express itself through them. A. Therefore, the soul is the form-building aspect, and is that attractive factor in every form in the universe, in the planet, in the kingdoms of nature, and in man, who sums up in himself all the aspects, which brings the form into being, which enables it to develop and grow so as to house more adequately the indwelling life, and which drives all God's creatures forward along the path of evolution through one kingdom after another towards an eventual goal and a glorious consummation. B. The soul is the force of evolution itself, And this was in the mind of St. Paul when he spoke of the Christ in you, the hope of glory. 3. This soul manifests differently in the various kingdoms of nature, but its function is ever the same, whether we are dealing with an atom of substance and its power to preserve its identity and form and carry forward its activity along its own lines, or whether we deal with a form in one of the three kingdoms of nature, held coherently together, demonstrating characteristics, pursuing its own instinctual life, and working as a whole towards something higher and better. A. Therefore, the soul is that which gives distinctive characteristics and differing form manifestations. B. The soul plays upon matter, forcing it to assume certain shapes, to respond to certain vibrations, and to build those specified phenomenal forms which we recognize in the world of the physical plane as mineral, vegetable, animal, and human, and, for the initiate, certain other forms as well. 4. The qualities, vibrations, colors, and characteristics in all the kingdoms of nature are soul qualities, as are the latent powers in any form seeking expression and demonstrating potentiality. In their sum total, at the close of the evolutionary period, they will reveal what is the nature of the divine life and of the world soul, that oversoul which is revealing the character of God. A. Therefore, the soul, through these qualities and characteristics, manifests as conscious response to matter, for the qualities are brought into being through the interplay of the pairs of opposites, spirit and matter, and their effect upon each other. This is the basis of consciousness. B. The soul is the conscious factor in all forms, the source of that awareness which all forms register, and of that responsiveness to surrounding group conditions which the forms in every kingdom of nature demonstrate. C. Therefore, the soul might be defined as that significant aspect in every form, made through this union of spirit and matter, which feels, registers awareness, attracts and repels, responds or denies response, and keeps all forms in a constant condition of vibratory activity. D. The soul is the perceiving entity produced through the union of father spirit and mother matter. It is that which, in the vegetable world, for instance, produces response to the sun's rays and the unfolding of the bud. It is that in the animal kingdom which enables it to love its master, hunt its prey, and follow out its instinctual life. It is that in man which makes him aware of his environment and his group, which enables him to live his life in the three worlds of his normal evolution as the onlooker, the perceiver, the actor. This it is which enables him eventually to discover that this soul in him is dual, and that part of him responds to the animal soul, and part of him recognizes his divine soul. The majority, however, at this time, will be found to be functioning fully as neither purely animal nor purely divine, but can be regarded as human souls. 5. The soul of the universe is, for the sake of clarity, capable of differentiation, or rather, owing to the limitations of the form through which that soul has to function, capable of recognition at differing rates of vibration and stages of development. The soul nature in the universe therefore manifests in certain great states of awareness with many intermediate conditions, of which the major can be enumerated as follows. A. Consciousness, or that state of awareness in matter itself, due to the fact that mother matter has been fecundated by father spirit, and thus life and matter have been brought together. This type of consciousness concerns the atom, molecule, and cell of which all forms are constructed, thus the form of the solar system, of a planet, and of all that is found upon or within a planet is produced. B. Intelligent sentient consciousness, i.e., that evidenced in the mineral and vegetable kingdoms. It is this which is responsible for the quality, shape, and coloring of the vegetable and mineral forms, and for their specific natures. C. Animal consciousness, the awareness of soul response of all forms in the animal kingdom, producing their distinctions, species, and nature. D. Human consciousness, or self-consciousness, towards which the development of the life, form, and awareness in the other three kingdoms has gradually tended. This term concerns the individual consciousness of man, and in the early stages is more animal than divine, owing to the dominance of the animal body with its instincts and tendencies. HPB defines man accurately as an animal plus a god. Later, it is more strictly human, neither purely animal nor entirely divine, but fluctuating between the two stages, thus making the human kingdom the great battleground between the pairs of opposites, between the urge or pull of spirit and the lure of matter or mother nature, and between that called the lower self and the spiritual man. E, group consciousness, which is the consciousness of the great sum totals, is arrived at by man through the development, first of all, of his individual consciousness, the sum total of the lives of his animal, emotional, and mental natures, plus the spark of divinity dwelling within the form which they make. Then comes awareness of his group, as specified for him in that group of disciples working under some one master who represents to him the hierarchy. The hierarchy might be defined as the sum total of those sons of men who are no longer centered in the individualized self-consciousness, but who have entered into a wider realization, that of the planetary group life. There are stages in this realization, mounting all the way from that tiny group recognition of the probationer disciple up to the completed group awareness of the life in whom all forms have their being, the consciousness of the planetary logos, that spirit before the throne, who manifests through the form of a planet as man manifests through his form in the human kingdom. The soul, therefore, may be regarded as the unified sentiency and the relative awareness of that which lies back of the form of a planet and of a solar system. These latter are the sum total of all forms, organic or inorganic, as the materialist differentiates them. The soul, though constituting one great total, is, however, limited in its expression by the nature and quality of the form in which it is found, and there are consequently forms which are highly responsive to and expressive of the soul, and others which, owing to their density and the quality of the atoms of which they are composed, are incapable of recognizing the higher aspects of the soul or of expressing more than its lower vibration, tone, or color. The infinitely small is recognized, the infinitely vast is assumed, but it remains as yet a concept until such time as the consciousness of man is inclusive as well as exclusive. This concept will be understood when the second aspect is contacted and men understand the nature of the soul. It must be also remembered that just as the basic triplicity of manifestation worked out symbolically in man as his quota of energy, physical energy, his nervous system, and the body mass, so the soul can also be known as a triplicity, the higher correspondences of the lower. There is, first of all, what might be called the spiritual will, that quota of the universal will which any one soul can express, and which is adequate for the purpose of enabling the spiritual man to cooperate in the plan and purpose of the great life in which he has his being. There is also the second soul quality, which is spiritual love, the quality of group consciousness, of inclusiveness, of mediatorship, of attraction, and of unification. This is the paramount soul characteristic, for only the soul has it as the dynamic factor. The spirit or monad is primarily the expression of will with love and intelligence as secondary principles, and the body nature, the personality, is paramountly distinguished by intelligence. But the soul has outstandingly the quality of love, which demonstrates as wisdom also when the intelligence of the body nature is fused with the love of the soul. The following tabulation may make the thought clearer. Monad, will, purpose. First aspect, will, enabling the monad to participate in the universal purpose. Second aspect, love, the energy which is poured forth into the soul, making it what it is. Third aspect, intelligence, transmitted via the soul and brought into manifestation through the medium of the body. Soul, love, the method. First aspect, will, held in abeyance, but expressing itself through the mind aspect of the personality and through kundalini, which, when aroused, correctly makes possible the final initiations into the consciousness of the monad.